Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
What'll it be? What'll it be? This is Dee Franklin repping NYC and from Wall Street to Orange County. We are here for the last regular season edition of the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast. Next time you will be joined by our presence, folks. We will be in Orange County, California, in the off day of the competition, right before the semifinals, talking to coaches and players on site. But as far as our New York program, this will be the last record of the year before we make the trip out to California. And after we're back from California, we'll probably have our championship coaches talk to us to wrap up the season as well. But no time like the present to address what's going on. As of last Sunday, the tournament fields were set. All the conference tournaments were finished. All the AQs and automatic qualifiers from the conference championships were given out, along with the at-large bids to send 32 of the best MCLA teams to Orange County, California for the Division I and Division II national championships. And let's just run through the bracket really quick. In Division I, the 16 seed making their first ever MCLA tournament appearance will be joined by their head coach tonight in Pete Nelson. In the Indiana Hoosiers, will face the one seed in Arizona State, the Southwest Conference champs, number one seed and undefeated all year long, Chris Malone's squad. The 15 seed is the alma mater of Indiana's coach, Minnesota Duluth, back in the tournament. Won the UMLC last year, but was missing the automatic qualifier and got their AQ back when Wisconsin made the move back to the UMLC. Duluth won the championship once again, and they will play the two seed in Colorado. A MCLA finalist from last year and just recently won their first RMLC conference championship for the first time since 1994. Virginia Tech is back from the SELC, made it to the tournament in 2012. Last year, they did not make the SELC tournament. The SELC was represented by Liberty and Palm Beach Atlantic. In Division II, Virginia Tech had to beat Liberty in order to win the SELC this year, and they are back in the tournament playing BYU, a rematch of their 2012 first-round game. Northeastern stole a bit out of the Pioneer League. Boston College lost in the semifinals to New Hampshire. Northeastern had beaten BC in the regular season and ultimately won the Pioneer Conference Championship to bunch their ticket. They will play the four seed in Chapman out of the Southwest Conference, who played Arizona State in the championship game. The 12 seed will be Simon Fraser, the champions from the PNCLL from Canada. Last year, the PNCLL was represented by Oregon State, who was the champion in Oregon, who was an at-large bid. Simon Fraser represents the conference in isolation this year, and they will play the two-time defending champion of the MCLA, Colorado State, Alex Smith's boys, at the five spot. Cal Poly, back in the tournament in 2012, was the number one seed, made it all the way to the championship game against Colorado State. Last year was a year in the WCLL that was meant for Stanford and Sonoma, but Cal Poly is back as the conference champ and will be joined by Mark Lee later in the podcast. They will have a rematch against UCSB. UCSB, an at-large team from the Southwest Conference. Cal Poly played UCSB early in the season to a one-goal game and will have a chance for some revenge. The 10 seed will be the University of Texas Longhorns, winning the Lone Star Conference over Texas State, getting some revenge there. They will play the CCLA champion in Michigan State. Again, these two teams could have easily lost out to their in-state conference rivals and made their conferences two bid leagues, but they prevailed, and they will play each other in the 10-7 game. And finally, the 9-8 game will feature a Westminster team, the fourth team from the RMLC, edging out Grand Canyon, who had an unfortunate loss to UNLV in their conference tournament. And they will, of course, play Boston College from the Pioneer League, who earned their at-large berth very early in the season, despite not performing well in the Pioneer Conference Championship. Very quickly running down the D2 bracket, Montana State punches their ticket for the first time to the MCLA Division II tournament, winning the RMLC Championship. They will play the one seed in Grand Valley State, who won the CCLA, did Tim Murray's boys, multiple conference championships in a row for the Lakers. Missouri Valley, a first-year NAIA program out of the GRLC. Second year in a row, GRLC will send two new programs to the tournament. Last year it was DePaul and Purdue. This year it is Missouri Valley in Indiana. Missouri Valley, again, a first-year program, NAIA funding, getting it done on a varsity level. They will play the two seed in St. John's, who comes out of the UMLC, not an at-large, not an automatic qualifying conference this year, but St. John's, St. Thomas, and North Dakota State is back regardless. Coast Guard wins their first automatic qualifier to the MCLA tournament. They were an at-large team last year. They beat Briarcliff in the Pioneer League Conference Championship this year, and they will come into Orange County as the 14 seed, where they will play Dayton, who lost to Grand Valley State in the CCLA Championship. Dayton was ranked number one for most of the year and are coming in as a 3 seed under the new head coaching leadership of John Ventrulo. Ryan Hart out of the SCLC punches their ticket for the first time. An NAIA varsity funded school has been in the SCLC and the MCLA for a few years now, and they will go to the MCLA tournament for the first time. Also had some fortunate inconsistencies in their conference tournament to help them steal that bid. They will play St. Thomas, the number 4 seed, also coming off of 2 consecutive MCLA championships. Concordia pulling it out in the Southwest Lacrosse Conference. They are going to their third consecutive MCLA tournament. They beat Cal State Fullerton in the conference championship. They will play the 5 seed in North Dakota State. The number 11 seed is Western Washington out of the Pacific Northwest League. They upset Western Oregon in the conference championship and ultimately stole a bid. The 11-seeded Vikings will play the 6 seed, Grove City, out of the CCLA. Florida Gulf Coast from the SCLC, head by Mike Doubledy. This was a team that was probably favored to win the entire SCLC tournament, if not Elon. They did falter to Charleston early in the conference tournament, but they had a quality at-large win over Grove City, so their ticket is punched at number 10. And they will play Indiana Tech, an NAIA varsity-funded school out of the CCLA. Their second year in the tournament had a very big win early on in the season against St. Thomas. And then finally, the 9-8 game will feature Western Oregon, who was favored to win the Pacific Northwest Collegiate Lacrosse Conference, lost that game to Western Washington and allowed the Vikings to steal a bid. But being undefeated with the wins that they had early in the year, including one over Concordia, who ultimately won the Southwest Lacrosse Conference, the eighth seed will be the Wolves, and they will play SCAD, who ultimately sneaks into the tournament once again. They did it in 2012. They do it again in 2014. Elon decided to decline their bid to the tournament this year due to injuries in finals, so the bid stayed within the SCLC and went to SCAD, who is truly on the bubble out. So now that we've recapped the bracket, let's get into the nitty-gritty. We are joined by Pete Nelson, first-year head coach at Indiana University, was an assistant last year, also in his second year as the head hockey coach for the club program at Indiana. Pete, thank you very much for joining us this evening, and congratulations on your GRLC championship.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Appreciate being here. it's been a hell of a year.
It absolutely has. Indiana going to their first ever MCLA tournament. This is a program that's kind of had a bit of an identity crisis when you take a look at their history in the MCLA, whereas in the CCLA with the traditional Big Ten powers for a while, found a more competitive home for them personally in the GRLC. You guys were favored to win it last year, but ultimately was a surprise loss to Purdue in the championship game, but you pulled it out this year, beat Illinois in the championship game. And, you know, the first question I got to ask you, Pete, is, you know, this being Indiana's first MCLA tournament, being a guy who's pretty popular in the club sports office, being the head coach of two different teams, what is the buzz around campus been like, especially in your realm of the club sports department, with the conference championship that you guys won and gearing up for Southern California?
I mean, everybody's excited. I think, you know, obviously anytime a first-year team like this is able to do something as big as we did, you know, essentially making history for IU lacrosse, it's definitely a big step in the right direction for our program. So obviously everybody's excited. We're very excited and, you know, just ready to get out there and get going.
Pete, you know, it seems to me that there are really a lot of similarities in many different ways between this year's team and last year's team. You were an assistant on the staff last year, so it must have been pretty easy to transition into your role. You brought a decent amount of young talent back, but ultimately, at its core, what do you think is the biggest difference between this year's team and last year's team, which allowed your Hoosiers to really push through and accomplish the conference championship and get out to the MCLA tournament?
Oh, the biggest difference has to be, I think, our depth at midfield. You know, last year we were a little bit thinner offensively. I think this year bringing in some good younger guys and actually some older guys filling some better roles as well. You know, I think that was the biggest difference maker for us. We brought back all of our attackmen, all of our defensemen. We only graduated our goalie last year. And then our junior Ward Weber from Dallas, Texas, stepped in and played amazing this year. So, I mean, ultimately, it's guys just kind of, you know, finding their roles and really, really taking advantage of the roles that they're given and playing that spot to the fullest.
You come into this tournament, Coach Nelson, as the 16 seed, obviously a tough draw to have and something that the GRLC ultimately does have to kind of just sit with and adapt with year in and year out. Listen, the last 16 seed that put up a good fight was actually your alma mater, Duluth, in 2012, took Cal Poly all the way to overtime. But you're playing a very, very good Arizona State team. They haven't lost all year. You know, so many weapons to choose from between Dan Davis and Zach Scarano at attack. Zach Handy doesn't lose a lot of faceoffs. Ian Connell might be one of the best defensemen in the country. You know, among those things, what do you think is your biggest concern about the Sun Devils?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously they've got a lot of power, and we know that, and you know, all up and down the field. But you know, at the end of the day, it's still a sport and still a game. And like I told my guys, you know, we got a steep hill to climb, but, you know, ultimately there's no team in any sport in the world that's unbeatable. You know, they possess the ball well. They don't make many mistakes, if any at all. And I think that, you know, that's one of the areas that we have to really work on is just kind of cleaning up our game and taking care of the ball and really valuing our possessions and understanding how important it's going to be to, you know, really take advantage of every opportunity that we get, because I mean, you know, any mistake we make, they're going to capitalize on, and you know, we just have to be prepared to go on some runs, and they're going to go on some runs, and you know, we're gonna give it everything we got, and I think that, you know, the guys are ready. That's the best part, is that these guys are ready to go. We're excited to be there, and it's not just somewhere we limp in and say, hey, we're happy to be here. It's, hey, you know, we had a goal at the beginning of the year, and that's to win a national championship like anybody. And, you know, that doesn't change no matter who you're playing or where it is.
You know, I think that's a very important mentality to have for a first-year team at the MCLA tournament. Even for teams that have been to the tournament before, they get a tough draw in the first round, like an ASU or in a Colorado State. Yeah, we were happy to pull it out this year, and we hope to have fun and be competitive today. But, you know, to grasp the opportunity and, you know, as a 16 seed, show no fear against Arizona State, you're really going to need that in order to have success. And, you know, another aspect that you'll need be successful against Arizona State is Alex Eaton. This is a player that I've had my eye on now for a couple of seasons, maybe one of the more elite two-way midfielders in the entire country. Later in this podcast, I'll announce that he is an inside lacrosse first-team MCLA All-American. You know, outside, you know, obviously he's a great scorer, but, you know, what do you think are the strongest aspects of his game, and what do you think that he's going to have to focus on in the first-round matchup against Arizona State?
I mean, the biggest thing about Al is he's a huge team player. He's a team first kind of guy, and that's the kind of guy you want. You know, he'll run through a brick wall for you. I think his athleticism is definitely his biggest asset. One of the most athletic guys I've ever had the pleasure to coach, and even really see on the field. It's pretty incredible the things that he ends up doing. Obviously he's drawn a long stick every single game. You know, he gets locked off, and then, you know, it's one of those things that his mental focus never really breaks. And, you know, I think that's the biggest asset that he brings, that he's ready to go no matter who it is or where it is. He, you know, he brings it every week in and out, practice, everything. So I think that, he's a huge asset, and I think, you know, he's going to be a guy that's going to help us, accomplish the goals we want.
You know, we talked a lot about, you know, what's on your future plate. And you know, it's really hard to analyze your future without looking at your past. And, your championship game against Illinois, similarly, to your championship game last year against Purdue, was, really a doozy. You know, you look at that box score, you look at the second half, you know, Illinois, you know, you had them in the first half, and it seemed like the Illini were fighting and scratching to take away, you know, your first opportunity to get to the MCLA tournament away from you. You know, as a coach, what was going through your head?
We almost saw a 29-year-old coach have a heart attack on the sideline, I think. I felt that to a few parents, but, you know, it was one of, I mean, hats off to Illinois. They never stopped battling. They pressed and pressed and pressed, and, you know, it was one of those things we kind of talked about what we have to do to beat ASU and stay competitive, is that we're making mistakes, and, Some bad turnovers, some missed shots, and they took advantage of it and went down and gave us a run there at the end. I think we had about 5 minutes left in the game. We hit three or four posts, and then they went down and scored to make it 7-5. And then we get a stop on defense and turn it over on the clear. They go down and make it 7-6. Minute 30 left in the game, we call a timeout and try and run the clock out and end up getting stripped, and they go down and get, two, three, four good shots off. And our goalie stood on his head in that last, 55 seconds, which was unbelievable. Ward ended up getting player of the tournament there, MVP of the tournament there for, I think, not only just the Iowa game and the Illinois game, but that last minute right there, I think really solidified his excellence in our conference.
No question about it. Great to have, with your one loss coming to your goaltender and have that be the guy who really steps up big in, your most important moment. Obviously, great to see in the development of your program. So, obviously, this is a pretty big year for lacrosse in Indiana from an MCLA standpoint. Indiana Tech was the joined Purdue, two programs representing Indiana at the MCLA tournament last year. You'll have an opportunity to do that again, obviously, filling in for Purdue's spot now that you are the newly crowned champion of the GRLC. Indiana Tech is, of course, a CCLA team, but, when you take a look at the work that your program in Indiana Tech has done in regards to, the high school talent that you breed and recruit into your programs, interacting with the local community, how have you seen, your programs in Indiana, Indiana Tech, and even Purdue, for that matter, help the effort of growing the Indiana lacrosse hotbed?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that helps us is that, obviously, being in Bloomington, we're a little bit further south than Indianapolis. And in Indianapolis, it's growing. It's really doing well. There's a few outlets. You have the Indy Elite summer team and Team Indiana, and you got Hoosier lacrosse up there for summer, and some different options up there. But being in Bloomington, it's a little bit tougher, about hour south of Indianapolis. But there's two high schools here in Bloomington, North and South. They both have teams this year, actually, and at least two or maybe even three of our guys are helping out with the high school team. Joey Morstein from Silver Springs, Maryland, and then Chris Lanciotti from Carmel, Indiana, are both helping out with the high school team. So that's great for them to be able to give back. And, obviously with the schedules they have for school and practice and everything, it's really nice to see them kind of find some time to help with that area and trying to grow it a little bit more for them. I know the high school kids appreciate it, so that's a big help for sure.
Always great to see your players get immersed in the local lacrosse community. And from a coach's perspective, I can tell you firsthand that, having a player come back to your team, having known what it's like to be in the coach's shoes, tends to mature them and make your job a heck of a lot easier as well. So, Pete, we've spoken a few times, even when you weren't on the podcast. We talk about it when we, interviewed Coach Limpert from Minnesota and Coach Hoskins from Simon Fraser. Obviously, we spoke with Sam Lippman about it last week, about the way that hockey and box lacrosse can really tie into a player's development. There's a huge debate going on right now in regards to if aspiring lacrosse players should concentrate just on lacrosse or play a variety of sports. But obviously, in your role, we know how you sit. You are the head hockey coach at the club ice hockey team at Indiana. You went to a school that has a great ice hockey program within itself, and you were an outstanding high school hockey player in a very, very tough high school hockey state. For the most part, how do you feel as though this, whatever success you've had with the IU Lax or the IU hockey team has translated into IU lacrosse? And, what is your overall opinion on the skill set between a hockey player and a lacrosse player in regards to how you would advise, a young kid in regards to using his love of the sport to be the best athlete that he could be in the future?
I mean, I think it's huge to play multiple sports. Not only hockey, I mean, really anything that you can do, especially growing up, young ages up and through high school, you should always play multiple sports. I grew up in an area where I lived on a park and had a tennis court and a, football field and baseball field, everything in my backyard. So I was playing roller hockey or tennis or hitting golf balls or, whatever it could be out there. And I think that's one of the things that not only, you know, helped me grow to love sports in general, but just to kind of develop that athletic ability and that competitive spirit, you know, that me and my friends always were just out playing some sport, whatever it was. And I think, you know, that's why we saw so much success from our high school hockey team and even our lacrosse team back then, is that every guy, none of us were a one sport athlete. All of us played multiple sports. It might not have been varsity. It might not have, you know, been organized, but it was always some sort of sport playing together. And I think that, you know, for young guys growing up, especially when you're recruiting as a coach, I think one of the biggest things is making sure guys, you know, are developing that athletic ability through a variety of outlets. And I think that's the biggest thing nowadays, is seeing guys who are able to pick up a stick who might not have picked one up before and become, you know, a better player just because they played sports and understand how sports work. So I think hockey, you know, maybe not hockey specifically, but I think all sports in general are great for anybody to do nowadays.
Absolutely. And, you know, Pete, on a closing note, I think one of the more special themes that ultimately developed behind the scenes for this MCLA tournament, you know, and it's very fitting that Duluth got their at-large bid back with the UMLC, and that Sam Lippman's boys were able to pull out that championship this year. But, you know, in addition to the Bulldog players themselves and Sam Lippman and the alumni and his coaching staff, you're going to have a lot of company. Yourself, Derek Dane, and Mike Double D from Florida Gulf Coast, all MCLA head coaches who are alumni of the UMD program, St. Thomas, North Dakota State, St. John's, and as we mentioned, Duluth itself have a lot of alumni on the staff, so you're all going to be in good company. How do you think that is going to make this experience for you as a coach leading a first-year program like Indiana, or a first-year championship-seeking program like Indiana, to the MCLA tournament? And what do you think, you know, constitutes all this success that, you know, so many guys who played you know, club or virtual varsity level lacrosse at Minnesota Duluth was able to take their experiences there, either keep it in-house with the home program or take it into competing MCLA programs and have them achieve the same level of success that UMD had and still continues to have?
I mean, it's definitely, it's a breath of fresh air for me. It's nice to know there's guys there that I can call and, you know, ask questions. Obviously, me and Sammy have been on the phone, and Casey Mathune was one of my old roommates, and Nesser and Cruz lived with all those guys in college. So it's fun to be able to get to see them, but it's also nice to have somebody to ask questions to who's been to it, you know, before. I haven't been back to tournaments since 2008, my senior year, which, you know, ultimately ended with a loss to Arizona State. 8-7. So I'd still a little bit of salt in the wound there.
Well, you have a chance for vengeance, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's the nice thing, is that I get to start right back up with them. So, it's definitely nice to have a couple guys there that I know really well and are still some of my best friends. And, you know, I can still chat with them you know, if I ever need anything, I know I can call them. So that's good. And I mean, as far as Duluth lacrosse and the coaching tree goes, I think, you know, a lot of it is owed to Rob Graff, who spent numerous, I think it was 17, 18, 19 years, maybe. I don't even know how long he was there, for a while. And you know, the way that he ran a program ultimately helped, you know, I'm sure it helped all those other guys, but it's definitely, you know, helped me kind of decide what direction I want to take this IU program in. And you know, obviously we did something right this year, and I think that, you know, guys are starting to buy in, and, you know, that's part of the thing that you learn with Rob, is that you got to buy into what he's selling. And that was absolutely 100% is that, you know, I would have ran through a brick wall for Rob, and he could have told me to go do whatever he wanted me to do, and I would have done it, no questions asked. And I think you know, that's kind of one of those mentalities that, you know, you got to have the players want to play for you, and you know, you're going to put yourself in a good position to win. So it definitely, a lot of it is owed to Coach Graff, and you know, much respect to him. So
absolutely, Coach Rob Graff still sits with a seat on the MCLA board and is definitely a respected MCLA figure. It's always great to see guys like him and even a guy like Frank Clark, who is a former head coach at Duluth, really rally around what's going on this year, not only with the home program, but, you know, the success that the alumni having with their respective programs. So, you know, Pete, I really congratulate you on a very fantastic season, and hopefully this isn't the end of the congratulations that you'll receive heading into a very big week. Certainly should be a very, very special week for you, not only with the accomplishments that you've had with this Indiana team and this Indiana program, but again, to really join a lot of your Duluth brethren. You know, Double D's team from Florida Gulf Coast, this is going to be their first tournament. Obviously, Sammy Lippman, Rob Horn, and Derek Dane are essentially veterans at this point, but, you know, this is definitely a fraternity that you deserve to be a part of. Your actions and your leadership this year have certainly, you know, the results on the field have even spoken louder than your words and your stances off the field, which have been fantastic. So, Coach Nelson, I very much thank you for your time this evening. Best of luck next week. I look forward to meeting you in person and shaking your hand and seeing if you could get some vengeance against an Arizona State program that knocked you out as a player. Let me tell you something. If I had an opportunity as a player or a coach to get another chance at Westminster from when I got bumped in 2007, I tell Mace Goodhand all the time. I tell John Robinette from Fort Lewis all the time, it was a pleasure beating your butt. And I tell Mace Goodhand all the time, you know, it really stinks that I had to lose to you. But really an unbelievable opportunity for you, Pete. I look forward to seeing you in California next week. And again, congratulations and best of luck to you in the Crimson Cream.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me out.
And the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast continues. We're going to take things out west, moving from the Midwest of Bloomington, Indiana, out to San Luis Obispo, and talk with Mark Lee, the head coach of the Cal Poly Mustangs, the one seed from the 2012 tournament, ultimately did not emerge from the WCLL in a very competitive 2013, but is back to represent the conference as the conference champion in isolation this year, playing at UCSB in the first round. Coach Lee, first time having you on the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast. Thank you very much for your time this evening for a very exciting juncture of the season.
Yeah, good to be here. And we're excited to head down to Orange County next week.
Absolutely. Obviously, a bit of a shorter trip than the last tournament when you made it all the way out to Greenville to defend that number one seed of yours. You know, the biggest question that I have to ask you is, in 2012, you were very senior heavy, very offensive oriented team. You know, admittedly graduated a lot of that talent, which made 2013 a little bit of a rebuilding year for you. But obviously, you're back to where you need to be, at top of the conference and the national championship picture. What do you think is the major difference between the 2014 Mustangs and the 2012 Mustangs?
You know, 2012 seems like a long time ago now. That team is really a culmination of a class. You know, we had one of the biggest senior classes we had ever had. They had been together all four seasons. Some of them had even played together in high school. So when we came into that year, we knew we were talented. We knew we were we didn't really have to change a whole lot. We just had to get a little bit better at the things we already did. So that was a definitely a different feel to it. This year, we've got some seniors, but it's much more of a mixture. We've got, you know, a freshman in the goal. We've got a freshman starting at attack. You know, it's really a mixture of guys, and it took a while for this team to kind of figure out how to play together, figure out which parts were going to work. And unlike 2012, where we really were pretty well set from the first game, we knew who was playing where and who was doing what.
Always great to see a program of a championship caliber who's had a lot of success and a lot of history in the past go through a rebuilding year, you know, kind of redefine their own identity and still find a way to succeed the way that they have. And that being said, you know, obviously it's, you know, the tale of the tape remains to be true. You know, going into 2012, your confidence seemed pretty clear from the get-go with the offensive firepower that you had, especially with Scotty Haberer and Matt Grautman. You had to make some readjustments this year and implement some new talents. And with that, you know, you fall from the number one seed to an 11 seed. And obviously the mentality of this season is different. You know, you just said that 2012 seems like forever ago. When you try to compare your mentality going into the last tournament as the number one seed, the dark horse, the top dog, You know, with a target on your back, now being, you know, just kind of more in the mix as an 11 seed. But once again, going up against the team that you played very, very close, just to one goal, you know, a regional opponent and rival of yours. What is the mentality and what is the major difference, do you think, from a coaching and a player mentality perspective when comparing those that were involved in the 2012 team who were a favorite in one seed that are now in the mix in 2014 coming in at number 11 for Orange County?
Yeah, you know, coming into the 2012 tournament, we were the number one seed, but that team had not won a game in their first three seasons. So there was a lot of pressure on us, and maybe we didn't admit it at the time, but I think there was, especially playing a tough team like Minnesota Duluth, and a team that hung around and actually was ahead in the second half. And luckily we were able to get past that game and then in the next rounds just play our game. But there was a lot of pressure. Whereas this team, you know, coming in as the 11th seed, obviously we're the lower seed. It'd be an upset if we win. We don't have that pressure on us, but we feel like we're peaking at the right time. We're playing our best lacrosse. There's no doubt that our game against Cal last Sunday was our best all-around performance of the season. So we feel like we're playing our best lacrosse at the right time of the year, and we're playing two teams that obviously are not going to be easy to beat, but they're teams that we know we can beat. We've seen them. It could be UCSB and then BYU or Virginia Tech. We've actually seen all three of those teams this year.
Sure.
And so, you know, we didn't beat BYU and we didn't beat UCSB, but both games were close. We were up at halftime. And so for us, it's really just a matter of who has gotten better since we played last. So we're pretty confident going into our bracket.
Yeah, Coach Lee, you bring up some very interesting points there. For one, is the pressure to win an MCLA tournament game. There are so many teams who have been associated with MCLA tournament in years past. But, you know, the guys that get consistently known as one and done, their relevance in the league and in the tournament is always questioned. So to go in as a one seed, having never won an MCLA tournament game, and then to have a tough draw like Duluth, you know, obviously, you know, can really cause a lot of stress, and even on the same side, on a different side of the coin, a lot of determination for a team like yours. And it was great to see you play a 16 seed like Duluth to overtime and then develop and become more comfortable and more confident over the course of the tournament, to the extent that you handled Arizona State in the Final Four, you know, fairly easily, much more easily than you handled Duluth in the first round. So obviously those are two pretty important things to touch on, and I'm glad that you brought those up. But moving on to the next question, you know, the WCLL, you know, this is a conference that has a ton of history. You know, the Mickey Miles Felton Trophy is one of the harder conference championships to win throughout the country. Obviously, the trophy is named after a coach from the University of Arizona who at one point was a part of your conference until the split, making the WCLL and the SALC and the SLC what it's known to be now. But, you know, the WCLL is still a very competitive league. You know, Sonoma State, Stanford, and Cal Berkeley are all teams, in addition to yourselves, who have been to Final Fours and MCLA championship games in years past at some points in their history. And, you know, similar to the SCLC, you know, you guys always play each other very tight and sometimes beat up on each other. But going from, you know, years to when your conference got more than one team into the tournament, such as last year when Sonoma and Stanford went, 2012, you were actually joined by Cal Berkeley. Now you're the lone dog from the WCLL. Do you think that that is due to the fact that this was maybe a down year in the WCLL, or is it actually a bit of the opposite, to the extent that everybody was so good and the competition was so close that when Sonoma just didn't get the better of Cal the two times they played them, that ultimately hurt them, giving them two losses on their record, which made them hard to contend for an at-large spot? We know that Stanford wasn't exactly the team that they were in 2013. But what is your perception of the WCLL in 2014 compared to the product that was put forth by your conference in 2012 and 2013, when more than one squad went to the MCLA National Championships?
Well, I think you're right when you talk about, you know, everyone kind of beats up on each other. When you have teams that you play every year, often twice a year, maybe more than that if you count fall, you know, there's a different level of understanding. You kind of know what to expect, and that sometimes leads to, you know, upsets that may not happen on teams that you're not that familiar with. As far as was it a down year, you know, I thought it was kind of a mixed bag, really, for the WCLL this year. obviously we were better than we were last year. And I thought Sonoma was actually quite a bit better. Their record didn't end up showing it. They had a great middle of the season where they knocked off Chapman and beat Stanford pretty handily. And then, you know, they just went through a rough stretch there at the end. But from my perspective, from playing them last year and playing them this year, I thought they were actually quite a bit better when we saw them anyway. And then, you know, Cal and Stanford, they probably were a little bit down. They lost the best two offensive players in the league from 2013, with Stanford losing Jack Farr and Cal losing
Dan Cohen. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that they, you know, Cal picked up the freshman Nick Sheehan, who almost made up for the points for Cohen, but wasn't able to kind of take games over at the end like Cohen was able to do. So I don't think it's wrong to say that they were down a little bit offensively, at least. And then, you know, Stanford always struggles with their talent level is as good as anyone on the high end of their team, but they just don't have the depth of a team like us or Arizona State or teams like that. And so, you know, when you go through the inevitable struggles of a season, some injuries, whatever else you deal with players, they sometimes have a hard time coming through that when you only have 20 guys on the roster.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I mean, you know, it's very hard to ignore the fact that Stanford was definitely having a down year offensively. You know, without Jack Farr, didn't really leave Peter Doyle many options from the midfield. And, you know, those two programs, you know, you talk about their depth, it is for a reason. And, you know, it's an interesting dynamic. You know, Sonoma State is, you know, a school out in wine country that not many people know about. And Cal Poly, you know, also little known by some people's standards, but, you know, one of the best engineering schools in the country, in an unbelievable location where if you want job placement into a company like Oracle or Twitter or Facebook or Google or what have you, you know, that's as good a place to go as any, along with Stanford. But, you know, the admission standards for Cal and Stanford are especially tough. Those programs can't even recruit players until they get admitted into school, and then they have to sell those guys against whatever Ivy League schools or NESCAC Division III schools that they might also be considering. And it certainly does hurt their depth at times, and it's great that they're able to be competitive. And I agree, Sonoma did have a lot of extra firepower and showed some more grit and character that I even see in, you know, tournament qualifying seasons past. But, you know, a few losses along the way, and, you know, an 8-6 record and two losses to Cal without being able to redeem yourself. I guess that's just kind of the way the cookie crumbles. But moving on, you know, you started off your season with a really nice out-of-conference win against the Georgia program, which made it to the tournament last year, but was undoubtedly down this year. But it must have been nice to start off your season with a 14-goal win regardless. And then, you know, you played Cal UC Santa Barbara the very next day, coming off the 14-goal win, and lost 6-5. Again, this is a regional opponent. There was a point in time before the Southwestern Lacrosse Conference existed, even in your coaching career, that UC Santa Barbara was a part of the WCLL. This is really one of the great old off-the-radar rivalries in the MCLA. You know, what are your thoughts going into this matchup? You know, you were right there with them. This is obviously a winnable game for you. UC Santa Barbara, you know, did lose a lot of talent from their firepower in the midfield last year, but still have a very good attack and, you know, a great coaching staff. You know, what do you think, you know, is the main difference and the main point of preparation when you analyze your 6-5 loss from February 16th and try to get a win in Orange County next week?
You know, yeah, that game for mid-February, it was one of the more well-played games that I've been a part of. And the 6-5 score doesn't really tell the story of how up and down and action-packed that game was. Both defenses were playing really well, and there was a lot of action, but we just neither team could really find the cage. So, you know, UCSB is always a tough game. You've got Mike Allen is one of the best coaches, and John Miller, who people may not know about, but the teams that play against them certainly do, who's the assistant coach. You know, they have one of the best coaching staffs in the MCLA, so you're always going to get a well-coached team. They're always going to have a good game plan. John always seems to throw in some kind of wrinkle defensively that we have to try to adjust to, you know, mid-game. And I think if you're looking from outside, it would be, you know, the strength of their team is their attack with Mix and Morgan, and you could certainly say the strength of our team is our is our close defense with Sebastian Zorn and Luke Wallon and the multiple other guys that we throw at people. But I really think it's just going to come down to, you know, who's improved the most in these past 3 months since we played in all the other aspects of the game.
Absolutely. And, you know, something that you and Santa Barbara will certainly benefit from, in addition to a large majority of the MCLA teams that qualified for this year's tournament, at least from a Division I perspective, is the new tournament venue. You know, people had a lot of opinions about Greenville, South Carolina. For a truly West Coast team, you know, you actually, you know, obviously fared pretty well in 2012, you know, holding on to that number one seed and taking it all the way to the championship game. But, you know, in how many ways will California and Western-based teams benefit from this Orange County location compared to venues past, not only Greenville, but Denver and Dallas as well?
Yeah. You know, once we got to Greenville, we really didn't have any problems with it. It's just that it was the cost and the travel to get there for us. You know, we're not in a big hub, so we always have to travel first before we even get on a plane. So it certainly was a challenge. But once you get there, I think everything kind of works itself out. What's interesting for us is we traveled last weekend to our league Final Four, and that trip is actually going to turn out to be longer than our trip this weekend for the MCLA National Championship. So we're pretty excited. You know, it made my life a whole lot easier these past couple months, not having to worry about travel plans and logistics, knowing that if we won the league, we'd just be able to hop on a bus and get down there in 4 hours. So in that sense, it was a lot easier, a lot less stress for me. I think for the players, you know, once the game starts, I don't know that there's going to be any difference at all, but it certainly makes our life a lot easier and our budgets a lot less hampered by having it out here in California.
Absolutely. And you heard it here firsthand. For the Cal Poly Mustangs, the venues in Orange County, California, not remotely as difficult as traveling to their regional championships at Novato High School in Novato, California. And, you know, I think that you bring up, you know, another good point. I didn't see, you know, if any West Coast team came out to Greenville and said they didn't play their best game because they were travel lagged, I think that they would have gotten laughed out of the MCLA community completely. You travel to where you have to travel. It's the national championship, and you do what you need to do to physically and mentally prepare. And I think that the West Coast teams, such as yours and, you know, BYU, Cal Poly, the guys from the RMLC, despite the time changes, everybody played well. I think that Greenville was actually, I thought that the fields for the opening round games were as good as they really can be for our tournament. They were close together. I think the grass was well kept, and they were easy to get to. Serene Stadium might have left a lot to be desired, and maybe, you know, Greenville, South Carolina didn't generate a lot of local lacrosse interest. But from a travel and logistics perspective, you know, there's no question that this is saving some teams a lot of money. And on the Division II side of the coin, you actually have some of these Midwestern guys who would rather be traveling back to Greenville. But I think that there'll be a lot more excitement and buzz around Orange County. This is something that the league and the community really demanded. I think that for teams who have played against Chapman and UC Irvine before, I think it'll be nice for them to be in a venue and stadiums that they're familiar with. I've only heard great things about Chapman's main stadium, and, you know, I think that'll do a lot of good things from a comfort standpoint. I think the broadcast will go well. The lacrosse network basically has a second home on Chapman's campus with the connections that Chris Marshall has. And it certainly should be fantastic. A little bit of a longer trip for me, but it should certainly be exciting. So moving on, you know, one of the things that might have really been more difficult on your team last year, in addition to all of the talent that you graduated, is that one of your best midfielders, Tim Albo, simply wasn't playing. If I recall our conversation correctly last year, he just had some academic commitments which superseded all lacrosse, which, you know, at an engineering-oriented school, you know, in any academic situation perfectly makes sense. You know, you could, I'm sure that Ken Lovick will talk to you till you're blue in the face about how, you know, he has to utilize players over a 5 or 6 year period, and, you know that they're going to lose guys for a few years, whether they're due to internships or course load. Even Northeastern University deals with this with some of their programs. So just fill us in specifically on what kept him off the field this year. And obviously, you know, how is having him back really been able to push you forward back to a WCLL championship level this year?
Yeah, well, I think you pretty much nailed it. I mean, you know, it's an engineering school. Certainly there's other majors, but for a state school, it's, you know, it's a very demanding academic requirements, and but it's also mixed with the class availability that isn't always great. So when you throw that into the mix for Cal Poly, especially architecture, engineering, people in the sciences, 5 years is not the exception. It's the norm.
Right.
So these kids, you know, most of them really are taking 5 years. So for Tim, I think, you know, it's just a matter of the finishing up the grind of the 2012 season, realizing that he had 2 years of school left and 1 year of eligibility. So he decided to take last year off and came back ready to go this year. And, you know, it really started, had a great weekend this past weekend. As one of our captains and one of our team leaders, it's been great to have him back. But we have several players in a similar situation. You know, Dylan Gonzalez was a I think he scored 30, 40 points in 2011 team, or maybe it was 2010. And then he had to focus on academics, and so he's back. So it's not an abnormal situation for us. We deal with guys that sometimes have to take a year off mid-career.
For sure. And, you know, it's always, you know, I think that's another interesting dynamic, especially when you're talking about the MCLA. Obviously, it's not NCAA or necessarily held completely to a varsity standard, depending on what perspective that you're taking. But it really is great that this league, depending on what school and what program you're playing for, does allow you to enjoy opportunities, especially over the course of a five-year period, whether, you know, you're doing a professional internship 1 year, if you're studying abroad, if you're involved in a very heavy engineering oriented program. And especially at state schools like Cal Poly and Georgia Tech, it's good that you can take advantage of a five-year period and not get crushed with the tuition costs there. And, you know, if you strategically work with your coaches and, you know, get 4 years of college lacrosse in over a five-year period and get your degree and, you know, get the goals accomplished to prepare yourself for whatever it is you want to do when you graduate off the lacrosse field, you know, there's really no better situation. I think it's one of the things that makes the MCLA and the programs in it like yours pretty special. So moving on, you know, I think that it's really interesting that you talk about defense being the focal point of your program this year, because when I think back to 2012, it was all about offense, 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 running good, guys like Tim Albo running the ball off the field, getting it to a ball carrier like Scott Haberer, who, you know, turned the corner and found guys open like Oliver Schmid and Matt Groutman and the other good middies that you had. But, you know, you talk about the defensive firepower that you hear and, you know, your guys who are playing close who are actually, you know, are absolutely sensational. But, you know, from a defensive perspective, the guy that jumps off the stat page for me when looking at your roster is actually your long stick middie, Chris Nespor. And, you know, you've had some good ones at Cal Poly in your time. Alex Reed from 2012 was a very electric player who ran the ball up and down the field and generated scoring. Chris Nespor was, of course, a freshman who saw really decent minutes and actually had three assists back in 2012. How has he developed as a player, and what makes him, you know, one of the truly best LSMs at the MCLA Division I level right now?
I think, you know, Chris is just a complete player. He's, you know, he's got speed, he's got size, he's got stick skills. He's versatile, and he really is a complete package at LSM. You know, he's playing face-off wing, so he's got more ground balls than any guy on the team besides our face-off guys. He can clear the ball, be a threat on offense as he's bringing it down, takes the best offensive midfielder game in and game out. But I think the biggest thing is really his caused turnovers. I wish we had decent stats on that MCLA-wide. I'm pretty sure he'd be leading the MCLA or real close. And it's not only that he's creating those turnovers, but then he's usually collecting the ball himself and then clearing it and running a fast break all in the same play. So he really is a beast. We love having Chris around, and I'm glad that we've got him for one more season.
No question. It seems like having an electric, you know, long stick midi can really be a game changer for a program. I mean, we've seen the way that Chapman was able to develop guys like Hap Knowles and Matt Walrath. Again, you know, you had a really special guy in Alex Reed back in 2012. And, you know, I'm excited to see what kind of difference he can make for you out there in Orange County this year. And, you know, one of the things that I have to ask you on a closing note, maybe not something that, you know, affected your program so directly. I mean, you know, you were the favorite to win your conference. You didn't necessarily allow anybody to steal a bid. You might have had some at-large consideration if for whatever reason you didn't win your conference. But, you know, you might have admittedly been on the bubble out. But, you know, obviously a hot topic with this tournament field is a surprising but not an unjustifiable decision to have Westminster get the last at-large bid over Grand Canyon. This was a decision that was ultimately reached over the course of the fact that, you know, basically, you know, your recent and most recent body of work certainly gets taken into account more so than anything else for an at-large bid with your strength of schedule. You have to be playing your best lacrosse this time of year to be successful in the tournament. And when Grand Canyon lost to UNLV late in the season, when Westminster had defeated UNLV early in the season, that was ultimately the deciding factor to give Westminster the edge. There were other wins and losses in common. They both had quality wins over UCSB, so those canceled each other out. Grand Canyon beat Arizona. Westminster lost to Arizona in overtime. You know, what is your overall, you know, opinion on that situation, being a West Coast lacrosse guy, in regards to, you know, the factors that got Westminster in and Grand Canyon out, and how it will ultimately contribute to what really is a very, very competitive and balanced bracket all around?
Yeah, I think, you know, when Boston College ended up losing in the PCLL tournament, mm-hmm. somebody was going to get left out that everybody thought was going to be in just a few days before and deserved to be in. But that's how these things go with the at-large bids. You know, I think both teams were ranked right next to each other, 8 and 9 or 9 and 10. We didn't see Grand Canyon this year, but we saw them last year. They had a really dynamic offense and a great run and gun style. But we played Westminster this year, and I was really impressed. They had one of the most really tough offense to stop. They clicked on offense as good as any team we saw. So there's no doubt that they're a good team. And I think really, if you look at their head-to-head, they didn't play each other, but their similar competition, I think it really just came down to Grand Canyon lost a game at the wrong time. You know, they lost to UNLV in the last week, didn't make the SLC Final Four, and they had to pick one of the two. And I'm not on the committee, but that was probably the toughest call of the day. And they went with Westminster, and I don't think you could have faulted them with whoever they chose of those two.
No, I completely agree. I mean, the fact of the matter is that when BC lost to New Hampshire in the Final Four, you knew that a bid was going to get stolen. You ultimately just had to root for Northeastern ultimately winning that conference, because then it could have been justifiable that because of Northeastern's win over BC in the regular season, that they get a second at-large bid and whoever the conference champion is, the AQ. But realistically, it was only going to be a two-bid league. Boston College losing as early as they did certainly hurt a lot of teams' hopes, and the quality wins that Boston College had early in the season against BYU and Chapman was just going to trounce out anybody else's resume. And, you know, when Boston College lost that game, I was admittedly reading Westminster's eulogy because I thought that Grand Canyon's record was better and that the recent UNLV loss was going to hurt their seed but not their possibility. But then I got word that Westminster was going to sneak in instead of them. It wasn't something that I was surprised by it. It wasn't something that I necessarily questioned. At the end of the day, I didn't even realize that Westminster had the early win over UNLV. I just kind of went with what you just said. Oh, Grand Canyon lost the wrong game at the wrong time, and people think that Westminster is better and, you know, on a hotter trail now, and was more competitive in their conference tournament, which is equally as competitive as the SLC tournament, if not a little bit more competitive. But when you take, you know, the time and the results that Westminster had in common between UNLV and the fact that, you know, Westminster had just only lost Arizona in overtime on the road for that matter, I think that that it was a justified decision. Again, surprising but justified. And if Grand Canyon beats UNLV the way they should have, if Boston College wins the PCLL title, obviously we're looking at a much different tournament field. But that's what makes bracketology in any sport Really exciting. And, I'll ask you this one last question, Mark, on this, theme of Grand Canyon and Westminster, two former Division II programs that came into Division I and found success quickly. When San Diego and Montana did this, neither of those programs have been to an MCLA Division I tournament since they won their D2 championships and made the switch. Westminster actually hadn't won a D2 championship since 2008. Grand Canyon had never won one. They had come in from NCAA Division II, spent one season in MCLA D2, lost to Grand Valley in the quarterfinals, and then came right in to Division One. But obviously Grand Canyon and Westminster have a recipe for success that is just different and more successful than San Diego and Montana. And it seems like more teams year after year are making the jump from D2 to D1. Davenport did this recently, and I'm sure that there'll be a few that even make that move this year. But, I really want to ask you this, because Cal Poly has been a perennial MCLA Division One power for a pretty long period of time. We've seen good Division I teams that don't necessarily have that BCS brand, such as Oakland University, who was good early on in their development, but then just became weak and matriculated into Division II. Technically speaking, at some point, if Cal Poly's lacrosse program fell off a little bit and wanted to be more competitive in Division II, you're not a BCS football school, so you would still be eligible for the national tournament. I don't think that's something that anybody is prospecting or wants to happen or whatever it is, but just being from a smaller school that has always been in MCLA Division One, that has always been good in MCLA Division One, who's seen some of these D2 teams matriculate up and be successful, and you think about the rules that the MCLA has to differentiate D1 and D2 teams. We spoke about school size and admission and how that could affect depth at places like Cal and Stanford. Obviously, despite being a tough academic school, a smaller public school, not necessarily in a hub of a location that's easy to get to, what do you think has been the main theme in Cal Poly's recipe for success from an MCLA lacrosse standpoint? And that being said, being one of these smaller schools that doesn't have that BCS brand behind it, but still is very, very good in the MCLA, what do you think that says about the future of the MCLA as more teams try to matriculate from D2 to D1?
I think what people need to realize and understand is that every MCLA team has a completely different story, and it's really hard to generalize when it comes to the MCLA. So you never know how one team is going to make the switch or who has backing and who doesn't. When, being on the West Coast, where we play Chapman and Sonoma and UCSB, and we have for years, for decades, all of those teams could be in D2.
Right.
So, none of us have D1 football. And we have D1, we have whatever it's called now.
FCS.
FCS. I think we used to joke about, with Sonoma that, okay, we'll go down this year and then you'll bump up and we'll each take turns.
Right.
But obviously that isn't what we want to do. We want to play at the highest level we can. And so does UCSB and Chapman. Some people I know look at it like, okay, Arizona State's enrollment is enormous. Is that fair? But other schools have support from the school. So Westminster is a tiny university compared to Arizona State, but there's a lot of backing from the administration, and that carries a lot of weight. So every school, every team's got to figure out the best way forward for them to be able to play the best lacrosse they can. And there's no one size fits all. There's no one way to do it. Our way has been that I think the biggest corollary for us, and I've talked to this with Alex at Colorado State, is we just kind of have a culture of lacrosse that we've tried to develop over the years. But we get $1,100 from our school every year, so we are not relying upon Cal Poly for financial support. Now we have 17,000 kids, so we've got a pretty big pretty big student body. But every school's got challenges they got to deal with, and they've just got to figure out which path is best for them.
Absolutely. And once again, you bring up so many interesting points, and I ask some of these devil advocate questions that don't necessarily, might be one off from affecting your program specifically, but I do it just to bring light to the situation, because I think it's great. You bring up a brilliant point. If Sonoma, Chapman, or Cal Poly wanted to join MCLA Division II, they could, and they could be championship-seeking teams without any sort of a problem. But you keep it together to be competitive and maintain the culture that you've had for decades. And it's really impressive. And you also talk about, you know, football status and school size. I think that the football status thing is an interesting rule. You know, there's only a handful of FBS football schools that currently have MCLA D2 programs. I think, you know, it kind of revolves around Houston and Nevada. You know, basically a few, you know, WCLL D2 schools and a few LSA Lone Star Alliance D2 schools. And, you know, I think that that's an interesting factor. I mean, there are certainly FBS football schools that are much smaller when compared to others. But I don't know how legitimate the rule is to say that if you're an FBS football school, you can't be a D2 champion. But I guess there is some sort of statute of limitations there. And, you know, for better or for worse, it exists. And I think that it's mostly a good thing. But I think that when people talk about school size, you know, and how it relates to budget and funding, it's, you know, whether you're in Division I or Division II, there's just a million arguments to go against. Yes, you know, your budget and your enrollment compared to other schools in D1 is very small, but, you know, your culture and the way that you coach and the way that you run your program allows you to be competitive against those guys. And then you look at Division II, which is supposed to be the smaller school division per se. In the same way that you or Sonoma or Chapman could be D2 schools, there are other FCS football schools like North Dakota State and Grand Valley State, who are successful and are very happy in Division in MCLA Division II. Mind you that the enrollments at Grand Valley State University and North Dakota State University compared to even a public school like yours, those schools are much bigger than yours and you're all public schools. But even when you compare the size of Grand Valley State and North Dakota State and the football facilities they have for their FCS team and how they compete with the likes of a St. Thomas or a St. John's who have tiny enrollments, and Division III athletic budgets compared to their Division I budgets. I mean, you know, everybody's got to find a way to be competitive. So I think you hit the nail right on the head when you talk about, you know, how you find your identity in the MCLA and how you stay competitive. You know, school support, school budget, having NAIA varsity funding and having the ability to give scholarships through your athletic department, obviously that's going to, you know, give you a lot of opportunities for success when you can offer student athletes that level of support and sell them on that. But, you know, once you get past that barrier, it's about, you know, the culture of the school, the commitment of the coaching staff, and, you know, knowing how to be competitive against, you know, the weapons that your opponents have. And, you know, you've certainly been a great proponent of component of that, have been very competitive for a number of years, or a great competitor for the national championship in 2012, and, you know, excited to see a lot more of what you guys could produce in 2014 down in Orange County.
Yeah, well, we're excited to get down there next Monday.
Absolutely, yes. We are only a few days away from being in Orange County, California. You're taking a four-hour bus ride. I'm taking a red eye, which I'll probably sleep all the way through, but good travel times regardless. I've had Coach Lee on the phone now for about an hour, and I do want to let him go soon, but we do want to wrap up this last regular season edition or pre-tournament edition of the MCLA Inside Lacrosse podcast. We will have a show in Orange County, California, with some of the participating coaches and organizations in the off day before the Final Four. And we will, of course, try to have a Champions podcast at the end of the tournament when I'm back here in New York, inviting the championship coaches on to tell them about their success stories for the season. And we might have a complete it is very possible that we could have you know, one of our two guests from tonight, Mark Lee and from Cal Poly, or Pete Nelson from Indiana, can, you know, have a 1 of 16 chance to win the national championship just like anybody else. So we might have a familiar guest when we get back from Orange County. But just a few things to touch on as we wrap this up. I want to wrap up this podcast by announcing my Inside Lacrosse MCLA All-American picks for both divisions. But I just want to make one last statement and address this now while I have a good amount of the community's attention, because I only have the opportunity to converse with 32 schools in person and out in Orange County, California next week. This will be my last MCLA tournament personally. I've had a great opportunity and great pleasure in being brought into MCLA tournaments past. This will now be my fourth tournament, and I've been brought in a number of different varieties. It started off, you know, being a media correspondent for Ethan Ritz, who ran our television program for a long time, with Fox College Sports, and he gave me the opportunity to go on camera for the first time, which led to my hiring with Inside Lacrosse and allowed me to get on camera with other lacrosse broadcasts outside the MCLA. And I've had the opportunity to grow as a broadcaster as well as that with the range of the MCLA content and the recognition that it deserves. And I've been very fortunate and honored to be able to do that. And at the end of the day, the partnership between Inside Lacrosse and the MCLA is a very good one. It all started when the MCLA sold the content rights for their own magazine to Inside Lacrosse. And even though that deal has evaporated, Inside Lacrosse has done a great job staying devoted to the MCLA content, especially when it comes to their web presence, because they do understand the high level of play that exists in MCLA lacrosse and also understand the wide range geographically that this league covers. Which applies to a lot of different things. So, you know, the legitimacy that Inside Lacrosse brings to the MCLA brings that right back to Inside Lacrosse with the scope of college lacrosse that Inside Lacrosse is able to cover fully. And at the end of the day, my decision to leave the beat behind is truly a personal one. Again, I've had a lot of great opportunities as a young guy to grow as a journalist with this league, with this beat. And it's something that I hold very close to my heart, being a former player in this league. And, you know, I've made a lot of great relationships and friendships with guys like Coach Lee from Cal Poly, like Brandon Schwinn from Michigan State, Kyle McQuillan from Liberty, Pete Moosebrugger from St. Thomas, Rich Limpert from Minnesota, Alex Smith from Colorado State, John Galvin from Colorado, Matchneck from BYU, I mean, Chris Malone from Arizona State. I could rattle off names for hours, but, you know, those relationships are really important to me. You know, these are some of the best college lacrosse coaches in the country. It doesn't matter if we're talking D1, D2, D3, MCLA club. You know, these guys, many of which I just mentioned, are truly some of the best in the lacrosse coaching business, no matter which way you split it. And that's really been a motivating factor for me to keep this beat alive. And ultimately, my decision to leave everything behind is just a personal one. Again, I'm a little bit older than I was 4 years ago and have taken on new responsibilities in my life, and taking a week off of my regular job and spending a week away from my girlfriend and soon-to-be fiance is just not something that I can continue to do in the future. However, I will do everything I can to make sure that the MCLA and the Inside Lacrosse continue to have a good relationship, so both sides can benefit from it. And I do have some people in mind to take over for me to give MCLA weekly content on InsideLacrosse.com, contribute articles to the magazine when it is needed, and also perhaps continue these podcasts as well. And really, I've just really valued all the relationships that I've made, both from the Inside Lacrosse administration, Terry Foy and John Gelati, obviously giving me a great opportunity here, the coaches and the friends and the relationships that I formed with the coaches with this league are outstanding, and hopefully, you know, those relationships will still develop even as I leave my media hat for the MCLA on the rack at the hotel in Orange County. But on that note, I will announce our Inside Lacrosse MCLA All-Americans for 2014. Start with Division One. Division One first team Inside Lacrosse MCLA All-Americans. Attack, Riley Seidel from the University of Colorado. Attack, Tyler Kirby from Simon Fraser University. Attack, Ryan Miller from Liberty University. And attack, Dom Boggiano from Davenport University. Division One first team All-American Inside Lacrosse MCLA midfielders. Elliot Chang-Tung, University of Texas. Josh Holland, Westminster College. Blake Day, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Face-off midfielder, Sam Clare from Simon Fraser, who is also an offensive middie. Also getting Division One first team MCLA Inside Lacrosse All-American honors, a more pure face-off midfielder, is Zach Handy from Arizona State University. And the last midfielder on the MCLA Inside Lacrosse All-American first team is Alex Eaton from Indiana University. That brings us to the defense. Division One MCLA Inside Lacrosse first team All-American, Dan Klemmer from Boston College. Defense, Jeffrey Dromenhausen from University of Minnesota Duluth. And the last defenseman is Ian Connell from Arizona State University. And first team long stick midfielder All-American MCLA Inside Lacrosse Division One first team is Clark Salami from University of Colorado. And first team All-American goaltender is Matt Alamang from Michigan State. MCLA Inside Lacrosse Division One second team All-Americans. Attack, Timmy Andrews, Chapman University. Attack, Jack Cranston, University of Colorado. Attack, Andy Ull, Texas State University. Attack, Liam Kelly, Texas State University. Attack, Brad Bokessa, Sonoma State University. Attack, Kyle Posler, Westminster College. Playing midfield and attack for Colorado State University is Sean Smith. Division I second team MCLA All-American midfielder Connor Schlegel from the Claremont Colleges, Claremont University. Second team MCLA Division I midfielder is Bryce Marakovich from Liberty University. And finally, the last midfielder on the MCLA inside lacrosse Division I second team is Peter Doyle from Stanford University. Second team Division I MCLA inside lacrosse All-American defensive midfielder is Max Berry from University of California, Santa Barbara. Division I second team MCLA inside lacrosse All-American is long stick midfielder from Cal Poly University, Chris Nesbor. Division I second team All-American close defenseman second team is Jacob Fulkerson from Brigham Young University. And the final defenseman on the Division I MCLA inside lacrosse Division I MCLA All-American second team is Justin Miller from Northeastern University. And your Division I second team MCLA inside lacrosse All-American is Warren Nielsen from Chapman University. Finally, that brings us to our Division I honorable mentions receiving MCLA inside lacrosse All-American. Attackman, Dan Davis, Arizona State University. Attackman, Dean Farrell, Grand Canyon University. Attackman, Mike Fabrizio, Brigham Young University. Attackman, Will Goodman, Florida State University. Attackman, Stephen Sattler, Texas A&M University. Playing attack and midfield is Alex Crane from the University of Washington. Honorable mention, MCLA inside lacrosse Division I midfielder is Ryan Walsh from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Midfielder on the Division I MCLA inside lacrosse honorable mention team is Colin Madsen from Westminster. Also receiving the honor at midfield is Matt Dobbs from Cal Poly University. And the last midfielder on the Division I MCLA inside lacrosse honorable mention team is Dave Apruzzi from Chapman University. Division I MCLA inside lacrosse All-American at LSM is Evan Klinger from Brigham Young University. The other LSM is Josh Tu from Virginia Tech University. Honorable mention, Division I MCLA inside lacrosse All-American is Spencer Warsick from Northeastern University. And receiving Division I honorable mention MCLA inside lacrosse All-American in goal is Jordan Lee from the University of Texas. And the starting goalie from Colorado State University's two-goalie system, Jack Regan from the Rams. We move on to Division II. Division II MCLA inside lacrosse first team All-Americans. Jacob Helmer, St. John's University. Adam Henlon, University of Dayton. Zach Grussell, Grand Valley State University. And Eric Schmid, United States Coast Guard Academy. Those are your Division II MCLA inside lacrosse first team All-American attackmen. For the midfielders, Division II first team inside lacrosse MCLA All-Americans, Taylor Dugan, Western Oregon University. Charlie Farmer, Grand Valley State University. Matt Clevin, University of St. Thomas. Dan Shakins, Indiana Tech. Chase Mastranga, Concordia University in California. And finally, the last midfielder on the Division II MCLA inside lacrosse first team is Doug Brown from Missouri Valley College. Division II first team MCLA All-American long stick mini is Matthew Van Kieran from Florida Gulf Coast University. Division II first team MCLA inside lacrosse All-Americans at defense are Andrew Johnson from Montana State University, Steve Mann from the Savannah College of Art and Design, and Andrew Markland, the freshman from North Dakota State University. Division II inside lacrosse first team MCLA inside lacrosse All-American is Parker Ferry from Montana State University. Division II MCLA inside lacrosse second team All-Americans at attack, Dave Hall, Grove City. Attack, Josh Puckett, Indiana Tech. Attack, Clay Malensek, Western Oregon University. Attack, Jared Yoshino from Lourdes University. Attack, Brandon Detterman from Western Oregon University. And the final attackman on the Division II inside lacrosse MCLA All-American second team is David Schwamm from Biola University. Division II MCLA inside lacrosse second team All-American midfielders. We start with Ben Martinick from St. John's University. Daniel Hochspire from Western Oregon University, John Lennon from Palm Beach Atlantic University, Faceoff midfielder from the University of Dayton is J.P. Hewitt, receiving Division II inside across second team MCLA All-American honors. And the final midfielder on the Division II inside lacrosse All-American second team is Michael Hatcher from Western Washington University. Second team Division II inside lacrosse MCLA All-American at LSM is Eric Dohler from Reinhardt. The defensemen on the Division II inside lacrosse MCLA All-American second team are Austin Ray from Cal State Fullerton and Joey Seiler from Grand Valley State University. And finally, your inside lacrosse Division II MCLA inside lacrosse All-American on the second team is Tyler Maroney from Florida Gulf Coast University. And finally, our inside lacrosse MCLA Division II All-American honorable mentions at attack, Dan Caselli from Grove City. At attack, Nick Scalzo from Palm Beach Atlantic University. At midfield, Pat Dreiss from the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. At midfield, also from the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, John Tarzian. At defense, Ryan Colby from Grove City. Also at defense is Chris Friedman from Briarcliff College, and your Division II inside lacrosse MCLA honorable mention All-American goalie is Ryan Zeilinger from the University of St. Thomas. That will conclude this final pre-MCLA tournament edition of the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast. Again, I would like to thank our coaches from this evening, Pete Nelson from Indiana University, as well as Mark Lee from Cal Poly. As always, thank you to the Inside Lacrosse and our executive producers on the executive administration, John Gelati and Terry Foy. Thank you to MCLA President Ken Lovick and MCLA Lacrosse Media Director Dan Morris. And we will have you next week, right before the Final Four out in Orange County, California. Join me and some of our coaches who will be competing in the MCLA Final Four for a national championship. Again, we could be very easily joined by some of our guests from this evening, both this coming week and the week thereafter in the Champions podcast. Everybody has the same 1-in-16 chance of becoming an MCLA national champion. Thanks for listening, everybody. I will see you. I will have you right here next week in Orange County, California, on the Inside Lacrosse MCLA podcast. Take care and good luck to all 32 MCLA tournament teams.
Inside Lacrosse podcast.